I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Dan Bilevsky joins me now. The journalist has just published his first book, The Last Job, The Bad Grandpas and the Hatton Garden Heist. It's described as the definitive account of the biggest burglary in English history over the long Easter weekend in 2015. Six British thieves, all over the age of 60, some in their 70s, came out of retirement for one last heist. They set their sights on the Hatton Garden safe deposit in London's Diamond District. Here, businesses whose trade was in jewels and the sort kept their valuables, as well as families stored their cash or valuables. The crooks, carrying with them their idiosyncrasies and habits and infirmities, drill through about half a meter of reinforced concrete to haul away at least $19 million in diamonds, cash, jewels, heirlooms, and gold. Mr. Bilevsky covered this story and has now pieced together such an enjoyable narrative of these criminals and their crimes, how they got caught and busted, and what happened to all that loot. Dan Bilevsky has reported for the New York Times around the world, including London, Paris, Brussels, Prague, and Istanbul. He is currently a Canada correspondent for the paper based in Montreal, where he joins me from today. At Dan Bilevsky is the Twitter handle. The book is published by W.W. Norton & Company. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Dan Bilevsky. Mr. Bilevsky, good morning.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. It's such a wonderful book. I know that some of the details having followed the story in the news, but it's just fascinating to read.
That's very heartening to hear that. Thank you.
The great detail that you put in this book. The thing that fascinated me was these are interesting people. These are interesting characters, obviously. They're even likable in a roguish way. But they're indeed bad guys, and I think that's something that we ought not to forget, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the challenges that Scotland Yard, the British police, faced with this case is that many in the British public saw these men as being endearing rogues, as being working-class heroes, when in fact they had victimized senior citizens their own age, including many immigrants and Holocaust survivors. So there was a lot of moral ambivalence with this story.
And that's the other thing you just mentioned. You touched upon how the media portrayed them. When you have the chance to take a little time away from covering this story yourself and seeing how your colleagues in the media covered it. It really did, the daily journalism, if you will, it really did shape how people thought about these people, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, they were right out of a film. I mean, as I like to put it, it was like a bit like Ocean's 11 meets Geriatrics.
Mm-hmm.
And the London tabloid press, in addition to the global media, became absolutely obsessed and fascinated by the story because these elderly men had come out of retirement to undertake one last great heist. And as a result, I think the media tended to turn them into heroes and idealize them. And that made, once that narrative was planted in the public consciousness, it became very, very difficult for the police to puncture it.
Yeah. Now, would you take us to Hatton Garden and this part of London? What sort of area is this?
So Hatton Garden is in the center of London near a district called Clerkenwell. It's an old district that's been around since medieval times. It has about 100 different jewelers, including De Beers, and it has narrow cobblestone streets. It's historic, and it has a tight-knit community of jewelers, many of whom know each other, many of whom are Jewish and Indian.
And this safe deposit concept, I guess we think of storing our own valuables in a bank. The safe deposit that they went after, it's not really a bank. It is actually, that's its purpose, right?
Yeah, you can think of it like a safe deposit box in a bank, but its sole purpose was storing valuables within safe deposits. And it was in a subterranean basement-like area behind, a giant vaults. And it had been around since the 1950s, and jewelers in the neighborhood safeguarded their valuables there and regarded it as being impenetrable, which obviously turned out to be not the case at all.
You know, when you looked at these guys, these older guys, and the motivation to do this, you also look at their past. I mean, a lot of them have long rap sheets or certainly skill at theft.
Definitely.
Were a lot of them retired, say, from that sort of lifestyle and then came back, or?
Yeah, I mean, most of them were retired. And one of the bad grandpas, Freddie Foreman, who was supposed to go on the heist, or who he was recruited to go on the heist, but he turned down the opportunity. You know, I met him. He's now 87, and he was an enforcer for the Craig twins in the 1960s in London. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, look, they were looking to get their blood pressures racing. You know, it was one last roll of the dice. And so I think the reason they came out of retirement was because of the chance to do one last career-topping heist, to feel like they were part of the game. And I think that's why, although what they did was immoral, a lot of people can't help but be delighted by the fact that they were undertaking something extraordinary, however bad, at a time when many people their age are in retirement homes having prune juice.
Yeah, and we read about Mr. Foreman in a recent piece that you did for The Times. He was asked to join this heist, and today he regrets not doing it, right?
Well, I think he's kind of ambivalent. I mean, he is 87. He's a little bit slower than he used to be, and he spent about 16 years in prison. So I think he kind of felt like he was a little bit too old. But on the other hand, I mean, he was obviously excited by the idea of having gone on it, because he would have liked to have been part of something like that, something larger than life, something audacious.
And if I recall, in the piece that you wrote, when you visited him, he poured you a drink. It wasn't prune juice, right?
No, he poured several goblets of wine, and over a very long interview that I think went past 6 or 7 hours, he began to recount to me, you know, various people he had killed and, you know, how he disposed of their bodies. And so it was quite a harrowing and very fascinating interview, although I should say, you know, he did time in prison for these crimes, or at least some of them, and he came across as a very avuncular, sweet old man that I had a hard time squaring with his dark past.
Yeah, but these grandpas that you write about in The Last Job, they're a sort of different criminal, aren't they?
Absolutely. They embody a kind of a lost era of London crime. They were old school criminals who operated by a very specific code of conduct, which was you tried to avoid violence at all costs, you never harmed women and children. Mm-hmm. And that was partly why they did the crime on a long Easter weekend, because they wanted to hope and make sure that they didn't run into anyone during the burglary.
And then when you get to know them, as one does in reading your book, there's a certain fearlessness that they have about them, isn't there?
Absolutely. It was a fearlessness born of age, I think. They kind of felt they had nothing to lose. Mm. And, you know, again, thieves of that era had the attitude that if you get caught, you do the time and you don't complain.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just sort of got on with it.
Yeah, what's also fascinating when we read your book is not only how they plan all of this and carry it out, we read how Scotland Yard reacts to it and how the work that they do in terms of finding out who did this and catching them. It wasn't as if they did this on a weekend and then, say, on the next Tuesday they were caught, right?
No, not at all. I mean, a big part of the book, and I think in a way the most exciting part, is the cat and mouse game between the crooks and the police. And what happened was that once they figured out who some of the guys were, because they were analog criminals in a digital age and did kind of stupid things, mm-hmm. like one of them drove their own car to the crime, which was a distinctive white Mercedes with black alloy wheels. After Scotland Yard figured out who they were, they bugged some of their cars and then surreptitiously listened in on them for several months, because they wanted to gather enough evidence before pouncing to ensure that they had enough evidence to be able to prosecute them effectively. So they were very, very, very patient and listened in on the guys for months.
And so you got, you were able to hear the tapes, were you?
Yes, I got my hands on a good chunk of the audio, and part of how I was able to reproduce the dialogue in the book so that it reflected reality was through these tapes. And a lot of it does sound like an audio version of Pulp Fiction, only, you know, with British slang. I mean, they would argue over, you know, whether they should have Indian food or Chinese food.
Yeah.
And in a very Shakespearean way, as soon as one leaves the car, the other three men, you know, start mercilessly making fun of the one who leaves. So, I mean, they were old men, but they behaved like a bunch of teenage girls in many ways.
You write in the book, too, and we mustn't forget this, about the victims. And you know, it's easy to overlook the losses because some people might think that, you know, if you've got valuables, you can stand to lose them, say. But for a lot of these people, you know, they lost everything they had, didn't they?
Absolutely. I mean, safe deposits, whether in banks or elsewhere, are repositories of lives. And people put their life savings in safe deposits. They put their wedding rings. They put their war medals. And so people had really cherished items, you know, wedding rings from departed loved ones and spouses, you know, heirlooms that were brazenly taken by these men who didn't think twice about it, didn't seem to show any remorse about it either. So it is very easy to forget that these people were victims. And also because it was, you know, in a safe deposit in our jewelry district, many people just assumed that the victims, you know, were rich people who had scores of diamonds, when in fact, you know, many were hard-working immigrants.
And it's close to $20 million, right?
Absolutely, $20 million.
How much of that has been recovered, say?
As of now, only about a quarter has been recovered because a lot of the gold was melted down, and so it's very hard to trace. And also diamonds are also very hard to trace and easy to smuggle across borders. So it's given Scotland Yard a huge challenge to recover the jewels.
Now, you cover this story through your work as a reporter, but taking the time to write a book like this, what were you able to find out that you didn't know before, say, and in terms of fleshing out details about the situations, the people, say, that must have been fascinating to take sort of a deep dive into all
Absolutely.
Of this.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the frustrations of being a reporter, even for the New York Times, is, you know, you never really have as much time as you would like to go deep on something. So getting to write a book and to really, really do a deep dive was fascinating. And I think for me, what was very meaningful is I was living near Hatton Garden at the time of this crime. And, you know, so the local ecosystem of the crime was my local pub, you know, the supermarkets that I went to. Some of the men actually lived, you know, just a few blocks from my apartments in London. So it gave me tremendous insight into the neighborhood where I was living. And also, you know, I tried to meet, you know, some of the wives of the criminals. And also it gave me a lot more insight than I ever would have had into Scotland Yard, because the police gave me access to the most senior officers on the case, who I got to know very well, including the indomitable and not very chatty lead officer, Paul Johnson, who's one of the protagonists in my book, who's a very nice and patient man, but, you know, doesn't say very much and never drinks on the job. So it was very hard to get him to talk.
Right. Now, you sought out some of these folks, the criminals, in the course of writing this. Did any of them reply?
Well, some of them replied. I mean, there was a loquacious Irishman who was convicted of the crime called Hugh Doyle, who I did talk to, but, you know, he at that time was waiting for his appeal, and so he didn't really say very much. Most of the bad grandpas didn't want to talk to me. I did speak to one of their wives. And I did sort of have some doors slammed in my face. Again, these kind of old school criminals operate by this code, one of which is, you know, don't blab, you know, don't snitch on other people. And so it's hard to get them to talk. But frankly, because I had the audio of their unplugged conversations in a way that gave me a much more authentic sense of what they were thinking and what they were doing than actually talking to them, because not surprisingly, criminals tend to lie.
The other thing that I was thinking about, Dan, as I was reading your book is, I mean, I just assumed that everybody's like the government's watching us, you know, in whatever city we're living in.
Yeah.
But London itself, and you've worked in many cities throughout Europe especially.
Yeah.
It's a lot more acute, isn't it, the CCTV
Absolutely.
Culture, isn't it?
Absolutely. So in many European countries, and in particular in London, because of the history of terrorism, you know, with the IRA in the 1970s and more recently with Islamic terrorism, there are, you know, I think more than a million CCTV cameras scattered across the UK and hundreds of thousands of them in London, which means police have the technological capability to watch people and to retrace the steps of cars of suspects once they figured out who they are. They also have automated, you know, license plate technology that photographs license plates all the time in London. So once Scotland Yard hones in on a suspect and their car, they can usually, through CCTV footage, retrace the steps and help solve the crime that way. And indeed, that was very much the case with this Hatton Garden heist.
The other thing I was wondering about as I was reading your book, you've had the chance to piece everything together and look at everything that happened. Do you ever play out scenarios in your head about how this might have been done better?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And
I mean, one of the delicious, mischievous, things about this book is you try and think, imagine if they had got away with it.
Yeah.
And indeed, they came pretty close. If the planning of the crime was meticulous, and in many ways the execution was, you know, ingenious. I mean, they didn't leave a single trace of DNA at the crime scene.
Mm.
You know, funnily enough, they used the book Forensics for Dummies to guide them, but they must have studied it well because they didn't leave a single fingerprint. However, they were undone by, you know, their being elderly analog criminals in a digital age, and so they totally became undone in the aftermath of the crime. You know, as I said, one drove his own car to the heist, and then also they disobeyed the number one rule of the criminal handbook, which was to have boasted about what they did. But, you know, if they had been smarter and used, you know, disposable phones and kind of gone underground, hid loot and never blabbed, I mean, they may have got away with it.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm not sure that would have made for a great book.
Right. Yeah. Your job with the Times, I think, fascinates a lot of people because a lot of us are paying attention to the New York Times, especially a lot of us are subscribing to it.
Good to hear.
You worked for the Times for a number of years in various cities. Was it, I don't know, culture shock is the right thing because you're from Montreal, but coming back to Canada to cover
culture
it?
Culture shock is very much the right word.
Is it?
You know, coming home after 3 decades away from any country, I think, is enormous culture shock. And, you know, I came of age professionally in Europe, and, you know, over the past decade and certainly over the last 2 years during my postings in London and Paris, they were really formed by covering, you know, terrorist attacks and populism and the rise of the far right and the refugee crisis. And, you know, to come back to Canada, which is a lot more kumbaya and a lot more liberal and progressive than other places, was, you know, a change of scene. However, I've been amazed since I got back, you know, how great the Canada story has turned out to be. You know, as we speak, I'm working on a story about, you know, the Quebec's plan to ban, you know, religious symbols for authorities in the public sector. And there's many other stories across the country that show that, you know, Canada is not as liberal and progressive as people think. So I found I've actually found the story here really, really fascinating.
And you were out here recently writing about the murder, the UN murder here in Vancouver.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I absolutely have fallen head over heels in love with Vancouver. I mean, I just absolutely love the outdoors and the landscape, for one thing, and the sushi and the sashimi and the ramen and the kind of richness of the Asian community there is incredible. I was recently out in Vancouver covering, you know, the sensational murder case involving a man, a cousin, who killed his millionaire relative and then chopped up the body into 108 pieces in a mansion overlooking the hills in British properties. And I've also been, you know, covering the whole issue of some Asians and Chinese in particular using Vancouver as a bolt hole or as a refuge for cash, you know, much of which is put into real estate. And obviously, of course, the detention of Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of Huawei, pending her potential extradition to the United States, has really put Vancouver under the global spotlight and is of great interest to the New York Times.
And so Canada is of interest to the New York Times readership, isn't it?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, Canada has the largest digital subscription base of the New York Times outside the United States. It's a fantastic story. I mean, you have the identity politics of Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
You have the terrible tragedy of the murder and killing of Indigenous women and Canada coming to terms with its colonial past. You have the whole issue of the relations between China and Canada, which are very fraught at the moment, but are very much called into sharp relief in Vancouver. So I think, like, every part of Canada is an interesting story. And then, of course, in Ottawa, you know, Justin Trudeau being buffeted by the SNC-Lavalin scandal. So Canada is fascinating, and I think also at a time when you have Trump in the White House, people see Canada as a liberal, progressive social model, and are very interested to learn how we do things and what kind of, you know, mirror that holds up for the world.
So you're obviously busy, Dan, with your work. At the same time, you know, I wonder if you'll have time to write another book, because if it's as enjoyable as The Last Job, it'll be something that people will want to read.
Well, I'm really gratified to hear that. I would love to write another book. At the moment, there is film and TV interest in The Last Job, which I'm very excited about. So I'm hoping, you know, to get it, if that comes to fruition, to get involved in the writing of that and to make sure that, you know, the authenticity of the story doesn't get lost if it's transferred to the little or big screen. Yeah. But I would love to write another book. I'm just now much more mindful of what a gargantuan challenge and task it is to write a book, and all the more so when you're trying to juggle it with like a full-time job for the New York Times or yeah. any other job for that matter.
And as I was saying, you know, you covered the story through your reporting, but at the same time, it's altogether different work to have to write a book about it, isn't it?
Yes, it's altogether different to write a book. It's a massive time commitment. It's writing and rewriting and editing and fact-checking, which you do in journalism as well. But, it's a massive, massive job.
Yeah, well, it's a hell of a good read. Congratulations on it, Dan, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest. Pleasure talking to you.
The book is called The Last Job, The Bad Grandpas, and The Hatton Garden Heist. W.W. Norton is its publisher. Dan Belefsky, its author. Join me on the line from Montreal. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.